We are living in historic times in European politics. In Germany, a far-right party won a state election for the first time since World War II. In Austria, a far-right party won national elections for the first time since World War II. And France has a government supported by the far right for the first time since World War II. And so I'm here in France to take a closer look at this trend for today's Trumpet World. Bonjour and welcome to Trumpet World. We're coming to you from the outskirts of Paris, where we're taking a closer look at the rise of the fringe right in Europe. In France, this comes in the form of the National Rally, formerly known as the National Front. But this is not just a French story. All across Europe, we're seeing these first time since World War II type of stories. Is it a coincidence that we've had these firsts from France, from Germany, from Austria? Why are all these people voting for the far right? Is history about to repeat itself? Does this herald the rise of a new fascist Europe? Now, before we dig into this, it's important to note, are all of these voters choosing these parties neo-Nazis? Well, generally, no. These are people faced with complicated choices. They have often radically far-left immigration policies that are forced on them, and only these far-right groups, so-called, will oppose them. They're not voting this way for the most part because they want the Nazis back. They want someone to solve their problems, and the mainstream media and the mainstream parties won't listen to them. Are all of these parties the same? No. They fall in different places in the political spectrum. Some are genuinely far right and just about neo-Nazis. Others are clearly what would have just been considered a standard conservative 10, 20, 30 years ago. Several do have roots that go back to the Nazis and to Mussolini and to the fascists. But even though all these different parties are different, there is still a clear overall trend, and we need to understand it. So let's look at France. The trends are broadly the same way everywhere else. So here in France, you've had the National Rally, which under its name, former name, the National Front, has been around for a long time, but it's been regularly excluded from power. It was founded in 1972 by Jean-Marie Le Pen as the National Front, and he modeled it after the Italian social movement. That was an alliance of Mussolini's followers that got started in 1946 to kind of keep Mussolini's fascist party going after World War II. And you only need to look at the original logo of the National Front and the logo for the Italian social movement to see that there was a very, very deliberate connection between these two. So for years they were there. For years they didn't really do a massive amount. They kind of would get 10, 11% in an election was a good result for them. But then in 2002, they had a breakthrough. France generally has two rounds of voting. If somebody wins more than 50% in round one, they win the election. That's it. You just have the one round. Otherwise, there's what's called a runoff. And in the presidential elections, you have a runoff between usually the top two candidates. And in 2002, Jean-Marie Le Pen made it to the runoff. He was one of the top two candidates to be the president. It was the first time that this had happened, and it was a shocking moment, where certainly not since World War II had you had someone on the far right so close to power. And France was shocked. And in that runoff, when it was just those two options, Jacques Chirac or Jean-Marie Le Pen, 82.2% of voters came out and voted for Jacques Chirac. He won by an absolutely massive landslide. And 71% of voters said they didn't really care about Jacques Chirac. They didn't particularly want him to be president. They just wanted to make sure Le Pen didn't win. And that motivated this astonishing turnout. After that, the government changed the voting rules to make it harder for the National Front to win local elections and start to build up support that way. But that was the high watermark for Jean-Marie Le Pen. He never made it any closer to the presidency, and it was very clear after that election he wasn't going to. So in 2011, he handed the reins over to his daughter, Marine Le Pen. And she worked very hard at image management, reforming the image of the party. She worked to make it look less extreme. She even kicked Jean-Marie Le Pen out of the party. For years, he'd been in and out of trouble for Holocaust denial. He had some very disturbing statements, minimizing the Holocaust, calling it kind of a minor detail of World War II, even questioning whether it happened or whether the whole thing was made up. That put a lot of people off. And you can certainly understand why a party that was modeling itself on Mussolini would have that kind of a reputation, would have those kind of policies, those kind of statements. But under new management, the party started to change its image and eventually its name, becoming National Rally instead of National Front, to try and distance itself from its history. Meanwhile, immigration became a massive issue all across Europe, including France, maybe slightly less so in France, because France has a radical Muslim problem, but it's one that's more homegrown or that's been there for decades because of France's colonial holdings. They've brought in a lot of migrants from North Africa, and they've been here for quite some time. But just like the rest of Europe, after 2015, this still became a much, much bigger issue. You had the 2008 financial crisis as well that really discredited the mainstream parties in power. And so it seemed that National Rally was finally set to win a major election this summer in France. In fact, they did win the European elections, and that was a pretty huge moment. And so Emmanuel Macron called snap parliamentary elections, impromptu parliamentary elections. And National Rally won the first round with 33% of the vote. In the second round, their share of the vote went up to 37%. But thanks to tactical voting, they came in third place for the number of seats. If a right-wing candidate was best placed to win, well, then the left would get behind that right-wing candidate to block National Rally. And exactly the same happened if there was a left-wing candidate in the lead. It was 2002 all over again, but all across the country and on all of these different local seats. But even then, the response wasn't as strong as in 2002. They did still manage to win quite a large number of seats, with both left and right uniting against them. But it prevented them from dominating France's parliament, but at a cost. France's parliament, the National Assembly, is now kind of in a mess. The far-left New Popular Front won first place in terms of seats in the parliament, but each bloc, far-left, centre, hard-right, they all have about one-third of the seats each. And it's making it very, very difficult for the National Assembly to get anything done. So on September 5th, more than 7 weeks after the election, France got a new prime minister, the former Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier. And for him to keep his job, a majority in parliament needs to not throw him out. That's hard. It just takes two of these factions getting together to get rid of him. And the far left insists that because they are the largest bloc, that they should appoint the next prime minister. So it's very hard to get them on side. But this National Rally Party agreed to support Michel Barnier. And so Michel Barnier serves at the pleasure of the National Rally. At any time of their choosing, the far right could get together with the far left and kick him from power. They're not part of the governing coalition. They're not formally included like that. But for the first time since World War II, France has a government that relies on the support of the far right. The International Politique Quarterly wrote, "It is hard to understand the importance of Emmanuel Macron's pick of Michel Barnier as his fifth prime minister." They write this because this could break what has been called the cordon sanitaire, this relationship where left and right will unite to keep the National Rally and before then the National Front from power. For years, mainstream France, mainstream parties of left and right have said, you cannot vote for National Front. They are so extreme, you should pick your main political enemy rather than vote for them. But now, with Michel Barnier, they've effectively said, yep, okay, we can do business with them. That's what Macron's centre-right party has said. Now, you can't have it both ways. If Macron and Barnier and his party can rely on National Rally to get what they want, why can't everybody else? Next election, if the right needs the support of the left to keep the National Front from power, is that going to be forthcoming? After the right has relied on the far right to keep the left from power? It may well not. And besides that, Austria, which recently held its own election, contains a cautionary tale about doing business with the hard right. Welcome back to Trumpet World. We're coming to you from the gardens of the old Tuileries Palace. The palace no longer exists. I think it was knocked down or destroyed in a rebellion. But it was once a great royal residence within Paris. And we're now in the gardens, a royal garden open to the public during the French Revolution. During the Revolution, the French royal family was imprisoned in the palace, and they had some private time to walk in the gardens. And even the French queen at the time, Marie Antoinette, had a section of the garden for her private area. Now, Marie Antoinette, she was the Queen of France. She was not French. She was Austrian. So in a way, this is a bit of a stretch to match where I am with what I'm talking about, but it does illustrate an important point. European politics are very interconnected. You've had Austrian queens of France, French queens of Austria, I'm sure. Their royal families intermarried. Their political movements all affected each other and fed off each other. And today it's no different. So we're talking about the rise of the far right all across Europe, and that does interact and rub off on these different countries. Now, as we said, this isn't just one trend. Each far right or fringe right party is different. For some of these parties, far right isn't even an accurate term. In some ways, for some of their policies, the National Rally would be better called a far left party. But Austria's far right party is particularly worrying. The Freedom Party of Austria, or the FPÖ, was founded in 1956, and its first two chairmen were former SS officers. One of their most prominent leaders in modern times, Hans Christian Strzok, was arrested in Germany in 1989 for taking part in a neo-Nazi rally and being photographed posing with guns alongside known neo-Nazis. Their current leader, Herbert Kickl, wants to be known as Volkskanzler, a term that officially made it into the German dictionary in 1941, defined as term for Hitler to express the bond between the people and the Führer. The FPÖ was once like the National Front. They were continually excluded from power until 2000, where, desperate for allies, the mainstream right invited them into coalition. The world was shocked. Every European Union member, along with Israel, imposed a diplomatic boycott on Austria. But the event was still a sea change for Austrian politics. Suddenly, the FPÖ was a reasonable, normalized party. People could vote for them. They were back in power in 2017 to 2019 with more sway than ever after the migrant crisis. In 2019, there was a massive scandal involving the FPÖ where they pledged to censor the media and there was talk of dodgy funds from Russia, and they were thrown out of office in disgrace. But they're part of the political landscape now. They got a new leader, they're back in. This time they're not just the junior coalition partner, they won the election. Austria's conservatives are in a tough spot. They don't want to be the juniors to this fringe right party. They may be able to exclude them, but it's a powerful demonstration of the way that allying with the fringe can empower them. There's a more powerful warning to France about what can happen from allying with the far right. This is the Place de la République, not the more famous one in Paris, but in Bois-Colombes, a bit further out. It's a typical French square, cafes, fountains. It just happens to be a square near where I'm staying. But underneath is an air raid shelter. You don't need to look too far in Paris to find history of World War II and what that city suffered during that war. And that was a war that was a direct result of compromising with the fringe right. Now, I'm not saying the Freedom Party of Austria or the National Front, and certainly not many of their voters, are Nazis. People in their countries are faced by these big problems from things like immigration, and mainstream parties won't address it. They don't know what to do. They rightly want a solution, and you can't blame them for that. But World War II history is instructive for what can happen if you work with the far right. There are differences to what went on back in the 30s, but we can't let that blind us to the fact that history is repeating itself in Europe. Germany held parliamentary elections in 1928 and 1930. They then had three elections in 12 months between 1932-33. France had five different governments between May 1932 and January 1934. You had so much division and the rise of some of these fringe parties back then so that nations became paralyzed and couldn't respond to crises. And meanwhile, economic problems mounted in the wake of the Great Depression. In Spain, the divisions were so deep the nation was torn apart by civil war. You know, this year in France, we had European elections, then snap surprise parliamentary elections. They were inconclusive. Perhaps, if allowed, France would have called another set of elections by now, but they put in a minimum of a year between elections to try and stop a repeat of that 1930s history. Germany is also very aware of this, and that has been a major factor in stopping the German government trying to deal with its problems by calling repeated elections after each election proves inconclusive. Instead, they kind of cobble together some kind of cumbersome and often useless coalition and stumble by. But it feels like every trip could collapse the coalition and bring back another set of governments. I mean, I'm recording this, and there's people in the German government talking about quitting and calling new elections. There's people in the Dutch government threatening to quit and call new elections. We're in the same kind of era of unstable governments, lengthy coalition negotiations, and frequent snap elections. In 1932, the Nazis won nearly 40% of the vote in Germany. However, until the financial crisis in 1929 and a little bit ahead of that, the Nazis had been a weird fringe party. And all across Europe, you had these small parties in the 1930s popping up all over the place that had never been particularly significant, but suddenly started pulling in massive amounts of votes. You had the Heimwehr in Austria. You had the Nazi Sudeten German Party in Czechoslovakia. Romania, you had the Iron Guard. In France, you had things like the National Christian Defense League and the French Social Party. Many of these were insignificant and then very quickly became major political forces. The same way that you're seeing in France, in Germany, in Austria, in the Netherlands, in Italy, in Scandinavia. There are a lot of massive similarities there. You have the Alternative for Deutschland coming from nowhere to win elections in Germany, True Finns in Finland, Vox in Spain. Some of these aren't as extreme as the Nazis, as I said. Some may have things that are praiseworthy, but they're symptoms of a diseased political system. And that's really what I want to focus on rather than trying to blame those parties' supporters. All over Europe, people are seeing their leaders don't have the answers. And then leaders in the 1930s had the same dilemma. How do they maintain their power in the face of these upstart parties peeling off votes? Hitler was initially brought into power by the mainstream right. He was to be their puppet. They were going to control him, and they brought him in as part of a coalition. Now, they allowed him to be chancellor. There's a lot of opposition to allowing some of these other far-right leaders to be chancellor. We're seeing that with Kickl in Austria. But it's important to note the way that the mainstream right played in bringing these far right into power, because the left was very extreme back then. The left was full on communism. They saw the Nazis as the lesser of the two evils. Could the same thing happen again? Well, the Bible has specifically told us to watch for history to repeat itself. That is what we are seeing happen all across Europe right now. And the Bible gives us some really fundamental reasons why there are these uncanny parallels to the 1930s. We'll take a quick look at that after the break. Welcome back to Trumpet World. We've been talking about the Europe-wide rise of the far right. In the years and decades after World War II, a man named Herbert W. Armstrong forecast the rise of a far-right European power that would begin as an economic union, that would progress towards more political and ultimately military union. This is the change that we're seeing build right now. Why was Mr. Armstrong able to make a prediction that we're seeing fulfilled so accurately? Well, Revelation chapter 17 explains this. This is a critical chapter for understanding what is going on in Europe. The theme of this chapter is this terrifying beast power that causes a massive level of destruction. So it describes in this chapter a beast that has seven heads and 10 horns and is ridden by a woman. And we can use other Bible passages to understand what this means. We don't have to throw up our hands in confusion. A beast in other passages is used to describe an empire, most notably in the book of Daniel. So this is some kind of an empire. It's led by a woman, which is a church in biblical symbolism. And it itself shows us what it means by these seven heads. Revelation chapter 17 and verse 10 says there are seven kings. Five are fallen, one is, and one is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. So clearly, this empire rises and falls seven times. There are, at the time that this verse 10 refers to, five are fallen, five are in the past, one is, and one is yet to come. A total of seven heads or seven kings that lead this beast power. So this empire, this European empire, is going to rise up in total 7 times, and each time it is led by a king, a strong authoritarian leader. And this is exactly what we see in history. If we look for when Europe was led by a church, and you had this empire that rose and falls 7 times, you can see 7 resurrections. You have the original Roman Empire that wasn't led by a church. So that's not one of these, though these are all, and other scriptures tell us this, all relate back to this Roman Empire. But then you had the imperial restoration of the Emperor Justinian in AD 55. You had Charlemagne and the Franks in AD 774. You had Otto the Great and the Holy Roman Empire as you get into the 10th century. You had the Habsburg dynasty in around the 1500s. You had Napoleon. And then you had Hitler and Mussolini in the 20th century. The 7th resurrection is yet to come, this rising European leader. Well, where is this empire going to come from? Well, Revelation 17 gives us more important detail. Verse 8 says, "The beast that you saw was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition, and they that dwell on the earth shall wonder when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is." What is this talking about? This beast that was and is not and yet is. Well, it's talking about how after World War II, so many of the leaders of Germany and of Italy went into hiding. They went underground. They went into the bottomless pit. There were a few high-profile figures that were put on trial at Nuremberg and things like that. Even then, a lot of generals weren't held massively accountable, and you had some people that were released after just a few years, but a great many others were just allowed to disappear. This is a subject we've had so much news, more come out over the last 5-10 years, where German government department after government department have done investigations, where a lot of these departments basically in 1946, they were like, okay, nobody in our department liked the Nazis. We did the bare minimum that we had to do. In fact, we did lots of little things behind the scenes. We did everything we do to kind of throw sand in the wheels and put a spanner in the works and slow down what Hitler was doing. It would have all been a whole lot worse if it weren't for us. And the Allies kind of accepted that and said, okay, great. You can all keep your jobs. What we've found in the last 10 years or so is that was a total lie. That a lot of these people were actually enthusiastic Nazis volunteering information about how to perform the Holocaust more effectively. And yet they were allowed to stay in their jobs. In this way, this is just one small way of the way that the Nazis went underground. Many high-ranking leaders were allowed to escape to Argentina. And you had people that were former SS leaders that were allowed to go and found political parties. And you had Mussolini supporters that could go and found political support parties. And then people in France coming along and copying the parties founded by Mussolini. And this is the big reason why we're warning about many of these different groups. And it isn't necessarily because we believe that everybody voting for the FPO is a Nazi. But the Bible said that the Nazi movement will go underground and that it's going to come back up again. And that when you see the 7th resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, there's going to be that link there to the 6th resurrection. It will have gone underground and come back up. And so that's why we're drawing so much attention to this, because this is fulfilled prophecy. This is it happening exactly the way that your Bible said that it would happen. It was in the 1990s that the CIA finally declassified a document. It was called the Red House document, where a group of senior Nazis had all gotten together in 1944-45, and it was with a lot of industrial leaders. And they talked about going underground, and they've talked about the role that German industry must play in perpetuating German power. And it's the same industries now that you see, companies like Rheinmetall that is doing incredibly well. I can't remember whether their share price has doubled or whether it's just up 50%, but they're doing massively well out of Europe's rearmament process. And we're seeing this beast rise from the underground. That is what all of these votes and elections are a part of. The pattern that you're seeing in Europe is exactly what the Bible talked about. So Mussolini saw himself as the revival of an empire that ultimately traces back to Rome. The Nazi salute is based on the Roman salute, or at least the way that Italian historians interpreted it. All the eagle symbolism and so much, even the term fascist gets back to the fascines and this symbol of Roman office. They are very consciously resurrecting the Roman Empire, and they went underground, and their supporters are now coming back onto the scene. But here's something else critical to note about Revelation 17. If we look back at Revelation 17 and verse 8 and verse 10, they're written at a very specific moment in time. They're almost frozen in a specific moment in time. It talks about, well, five are fallen, one is, and one is not yet come. And that really confuses a lot of people. They're looking for this series of rising and falling empires. They can understand that a beast is an empire. And, okay, well, five are fallen, one is on the scene, one is not yet come. And they're like, well, is that when John was writing the book of Revelation? Was that the case then, that five were fallen and one was on the scene? Is the Roman Empire the one on the scene? Is there just one more to come? Well, no, actually, even the way that this is worded is a prophecy about when God would reveal the meaning of Revelation chapter 17. That he would reveal what this means at the time where one is, when five are fallen and when one is, God would reveal that truth. And God always reveals his truth through one man. Now you look throughout history, God in the Old Testament, you would have one man in charge. And at times in the Old Testament, you had multiple prophets, just like in the New, where you had multiple apostles, where they're having to travel all over the earth and they have jobs and missions where they can't be in communication with each other. But there's a clear hierarchy and there's a clear leadership. Peter was the chief apostle. You had people like Moses or like Elijah that were clearly in these very prominent leading roles in the Old Testament. And God says he doesn't change. It's the same today. He works through one man. And so this means that God would have a man on the scene during the time where one is and five are fallen. That he would have a man that he was using to, that he would reveal Revelation 17 to, and that he would then get this message out to the world. And there are numerous other prophecies that talk about God having a man on the scene towards the end, a man filling a very critical role towards the end of man's rule over man. And so God revealed this truth of Revelation 17 through Herbert W. Armstrong. He was here while the beast was and not is, during the sixth head. And he went on to continue to get this message out about this Holy Roman Empire. And he was there during World War II. He was there when the beast went underground. But then when it says, shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, it's future tense. That beast wouldn't begin ascending out of the bottomless pit while that man was on the scene. Herbert W. Armstrong died in 1986, and just 3 years later, the Berlin Wall came down and Germany reunified, and you get some of the very earliest signs of this beast rising out of the beast power. This all gets back to the big reason why we talk so much about this prophecy. It's about warning what is next, yes, absolutely, but it's about pointing you back to the Bible, back to God, back to the way that God works. This is about God's love for mankind, God wanting to get a warning message out to mankind. And God demonstrating his power by forecasting in precise detail all of the prophecies that you see today. All of these events, God is demonstrating that he is in control. Now, you don't believe a man, don't take a man's word from it. Yes, God works through men, but he still says, well, prove all things. So you need to find the man that God is using, and then you need to use the Bible to prove what he is saying. Even the book of Revelation, it praises the Ephesians who took the words of people who claimed to be apostles and tested them. And some they rejected because they couldn't prove what they were saying. So this isn't about just taking a man's word for it or following a man, but we need to find the man God is working through. Herbert W. Armstrong forecast the rise of a European Union. He used that term right in 1945 because of this revealed prophecy. You know, God showed him Revelation 17. It says there's going to be 10 nations, and he's looking at the world around, and God is influencing his mind and showing, well, how's this going to happen? Well, he said you're going to have a union of nations in Europe. It's going to start as a political union. It will become a monetary union. There are other prophecies that give us more details. And because of those, he said, well, you're going to have some of these countries that are locked behind the Iron Curtain right now. They're going to break away somehow. Some countries are going to get out from behind the Iron Curtain and they're going to join this European combine. That is exactly what we have seen. And then to have this transformation in politics across all of these different 10 nations. Well, That's what we're seeing right now, for these 10 nations to all come together. It says they give their strength and mind and power unto the beast. They all give their power unto an overall king. There've got to be some common trends in these nations. They've got to be thinking the same way. And that's what we're watching happen. Revelation 17, verse 12 and 13 says, "And the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast." So there are 10 different kings, 10 different dictators, 10 different countries that all have some kind of transformation in their politics. And then there's an overall strong leader that comes to the fore. So what does this mean practically for what we've been talking about? Are we saying these fringe parties are going to win, that you're going to have the leaders of these fringe parties become these kings? We'll take a short break and we'll finish the show up by talking about a different resurrection very closely associated with France that points us to what could soon happen. You might just be able to make out over my shoulder an area of Paris called La Défense, France's business district. It looks pretty impressive. It really dominates the horizon almost anywhere you are in Paris. It looks very modern, prosperous, sophisticated, but it's all an illusion. It's a mirage. France's economy is in trouble. The government is heavily in debt. Prime Minister Michel Barnier addressed the National Assembly on October 1st and told them, "The sword of Damocles hanging over us is our colossal financial debt." And it's not just France that is struggling with some pretty major economic problems. Former European Central Bank head Mario Draghi, once the most powerful of all of Europe's unelected bureaucrats, admits that the situation is dire. He had a report that he put out on September 9th where he said that he had nightmares about Europe's future and that the slow agony of its decline can only be reversed with radical change. "For the first time since the Cold War," he wrote, "we must genuinely fear for our self-preservation." And he's talking about the economic problems, that will people even want to remain in and put up with an EU that doesn't bring them prosperity? He highlighted some pretty shocking statistics about Europe's long-term economic issues. So since the year 2000, for example, income in the United States has grown twice as fast as in the European Union. He looked at six American companies that are now worth more than $1 trillion that were all founded within the last 50 years. You cannot find any European equivalents. There are no European companies founded within the last 50 years that are even worth $100 billion. That dynamism, where you can just start a company and grow it to a gigantic size, just isn't here in Europe. So on many fronts, Europe needs reform. They need it on immigration, they need it in finance, and they can't get it. And one of the only things there's an absolute majority for in France's parliament is lowering the retirement age. But it's absolutely unaffordable. A big part of this stagnation is the result of the political problems that we've been talking about. Europe is desperate not to let the fringe into power. And to do that, they've been having these left-right coalitions that don't agree. They certainly can't agree on big, bold, major reforms. Everything is pretty placid and non-controversial and non-impactful, ultimately. And so everything is just kind of stagnating. The continent is gradually growing poorer, and nobody will step up there with a radical vision to turn things around. Well, France is full of history of what happens if you reach that state. You know, a divided France couldn't agree measures to avert bankruptcy. Throw in some unusually bad harvests, and the result was the storming of the Bastille and the execution of the monarch. So this is another place that this trend could end up. This is the National Estate of Saint-Cloud, another place where a palace used to stand. Apparently, that's a theme of some of these recordings. It was here that France's post-revolutionary government met, largely to squabble. By 1799, it was clear that they had completely ceased to function. It was a general named Napoleon Bonaparte who came right here to put a stop to them. But if it hadn't have been him, it would have been someone else. In fact, Napoleon himself was launching a coup within a coup, pretending that he was actually helping someone else take power, only to take power himself. Napoleon Bonaparte also led a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. He was much more sophisticated than someone like Adolf Hitler was.
Until later in his reign, he was widely regarded, highly regarded by luminaries all across Europe. People like Beethoven or Goethe, great musicians, writers, scientists, academics, all thought of him as a great man. This new strong man that is coming is probably also going to be a much more sophisticated individual who is well regarded by the elites of his day. These European-wide trends are paving the way for this new strongman. That's what makes them so significant. He may well not come from one of these smaller fringe parties. He might be somebody with a lot higher, a lot wider appeal. So the Bible points us to the rise of this strongman, but more important than that, it points you to the God that prophesied this in advance in all this incredible detail. A lot of people in France still revere Napoleon. But whatever you think of his domestic policies, he led Europe into a war that they'd not seen the likes of for centuries. His boundless ambition of conquest led to France itself being invaded. This new strongman will be much the same. He'll plunge the world into war, but that war will return to Europe. But the Bible that foretells his rise so precisely says he will be the last leader that we see of the Holy Roman Empire. There will be no more rises and falls. Jesus Christ himself is about to return to stop him. This is all in context of God preparing the world for his rule.
We have a free book that will help you get much more deeply into this history to prove and understand it for yourself. It's called The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. I'll also mention our kind of much bigger size booklet, a letter or A4 size booklet, He Was Right. And that is your guide to the prophecy revealed to Herbert W. Armstrong that was subsequently proven true. And you can see how dramatically so many of his statements have unfolded over the years. You can get both of those at our website, thetrumpet.com. As usual, we would be more than happy to send those to you. You can read them online, or again, as usual, we really encourage you to get your own free print copy so that you can study this and prove this for yourself. Well, that is it for today's Trumpet World. Thanks to George Haddad for engineering and production. Please do send in any feedback. This was a bit of an experiment filming in France. Hopefully, in the future, we can bring you interviews and things like that, but this kind of helped us figure out what equipment we need to be able to make productions on the road, what shortcomings we have, things we need to learn how to do better. So we're still learning with that. If you do have any comments, any feedback, you can send that to trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and until next time, keep watching your world.